Hey, Will, you're on mute.
You would think we got the hang of this by now. Okay, well, I'll start over. Welcome to the March 8th meeting of the PUD Commission. Of course, this is another virtual meeting. We'll be doing this for who knows how long. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. First is approval of the consent agenda, which I think we all have.
Will?
Any comments or questions on the consent agenda?
Yes.
Will? Rick, you're muted.
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay, go ahead, Jim.
It's just a clarification on the invoices. I don't know, Sean or somebody, you've got a couple consulting. Well, let me do it this way. You've got something called BHC Consultants, App 3 Coordination for 10,772. What is that?
Lori, do you recall what that one was? I'm not remembering off the top of my head.
Tom's raising his hand. What's that, Tom?
That is one of the consultants, engineering firm BHC, that is working on the upgrades of infrastructure in Clown Bay CQ water system.
Okay, thanks. And then there's another one for something called Ivoxy, A-I-V-O-X-Y Consulting for $44,000 for tech for forks.
Someone can answer that one.
Yeah, I don't see Steve on here. That might be from Steve's.
Is that the furniture, Doug?
Oh, what was it again? What was the name?
It was called Ivoxy. It's like I-V-O-X-Y Consulting for forks.
Forks. Okay. That might be the furniture for the new building out there. We can check on that.
All right, let me know. It's not clear. Most of these things I can pick up, but that one I couldn't figure. And then Sound Publishing, we show $5,000 for advertising hotline. Is that really advertising?
Let's see.
Hi, Jim. This is Nicole. That's probably the hotline newsletter production.
So is that a printing cost?
They do the printing, and then we have a separate charge from Olympic Mailing Services for the postage.
Okay. Printing. All right. And then I don't know if it matters, but you've got the bad debt write-offs in there twice. Those three pages are duplicated.
Oh, we'll just double them, I guess.
No. Yeah, there you go. Plan ahead, right?
That's right.
That's all I had, was just those clarifications.
Okay, thank you, Jim. Any other questions, or do we have a motion?
I move that we accept the consent agenda.
I'll second it.
It's been moved and seconded that the consent agenda for May 8th, 2021 be approved as submitted. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Okay, agenda revisions. Doug, do we have anything?
Yeah, we've got the one under correspondence communications, PNNL. Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. They couldn't make today's agenda, so we're postponing it to another date.
Okay, we'll just reschedule them in the future sometime when they're available.
Right,
Will?
We'll do that.
Yes, Rick.
I would like to add another item for the agenda, which would be asking the staff to put together a letter supporting the Lower Snake River dams.
Okay.
Okay. What kind of staff effort, and what are we going to do to provide supporting information to make that decision on?
I think what Rick's asking is that Will adds it to the business items today, so it'll be one of the business items, and then the commissioners can discuss it. I would assume it's like a resolution, but the commissioners can decide on that.
Yeah, there's no action involved in this as I read it. It's just asking staff to put together something for our consideration.
Okay.
Any other agenda revisions? Anything from the board? Okay. Moving on to business items, our first item is acceptance memo of completion for contract number 201-008. Tom Martin, I believe you have that one.
Hey, real quick, Will, we skipped item number 4, comments from the public.
Oh, my goodness. My goodness. Sorry. Okay. Well, let's back up then. Do we have anybody, Sean, on the line?
Nothing from chat, but if anybody wants to make a comment, go ahead and give me your first name now, and I can put it on a list.
Let me just ask one thing. Give Sean your name, of course, and state whether or not you're a customer of the PUD. I see we've got a number of telephone numbers outside the area. And also, if we have comments and there's – if you just want to repeat something somebody else has said, that's just time-consuming, doesn't really achieve anything. So, all right, go ahead, John.
Anybody from the public want to make a comment at this time? Hearing none, Will.
Okay, good. All right, then we'll go back to business items. Acceptance memo for completion of contract number 201-008, and Mr. Tom Martin, you've got that one.
Thank you. Good afternoon, commissioners. This project is the Winter Haven Water Main construction. Two Grade LLC was the contractor on this. They started at the beginning of the year and worked all month pretty much through January and completed installation of about 630 feet of new water main. And this was a strategic project. We formed a loop in the Gales Addition water system. The pipe ran from Mount Pleasant Road over to a dead end on Winter Haven Road, which is off Beeland, just south of Highway 101, across from Safeway, around that area. So the original contract amount was $108,350, and one change order for about $4,000 for a total of $92,273. So it's great to have a loop in that area now. It provides a lot better fire flow for that area, as well as improving water quality in that area, which we've had some troubles with cross connection and backflow issues there. This project addressed both of them. It's a really great improvement. So we're asking the commissioners to accept this project as complete.
Tom, I guess it came in right on the contract. No change orders?
No, there was one change order for about $4,000. $4,044.
So that's an acceptable percentage. That's
yeah.
Great. Thank you. So would you have questions or comments or a motion?
I move that we accept the memo of completion for contract number 201-008.
I'll second that.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded for acceptance for completion of contract number 201-008. I'll go ahead and read all of this. This will authorize acceptance memo for completion for contract number 201008 with two grade LLC. The project consisted of installing a water main under Winter Haven Drive near Mount Pleasant Road to create a distribution system loop in the Gales Edition water system east of Port Angeles. Work started on December the 17th, 2020, and was completed on January the 29th, 2021, for a total contract price of $92,273.53, including Washington State sales tax. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you, Commissioners.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Next item is a WAPAG presentation on the energy imbalance market. Mr. Ryan Neal, Sean, I think you're going to do an introduction there.
Yeah, so back in November, the board had mentioned that it would like some additional information on the process for the post-2028 contracts with Bonneville, as well as some information on BPA's potential for joining the energy imbalance market. So after that meeting, I reached out to Ryan, who leads our WAPEG meetings, and he agreed to share some insights and answer any questions from the board on those two topics. But for those of you who don't know Ryan, he's an attorney with Mill Creek Law, and he leads the Western Public Agencies Group meetings for utilities, not only in Washington, but there's some from Oregon and California as well. He specializes in utility law and is actively engaged with organizations like PPC and Bonneville. So it's a real privilege to have someone with Ryan's knowledge and expertise on these BPA matters to talk to us today, and I'm sure it will be informing for the public as well. So thank you, Ryan, for being here today and presenting. I know that we all appreciate it. And with that, I'll go ahead and turn it over to you and start your presentation here. Just give me 2 seconds.
Yeah, welcome, Ryan. I still think of Terry Mundorf when I think of WAPAG, but you've been around for a while.
Yeah, I appreciate the invite, and Terry's still around, and when he's not hunting, obviously, or fishing for that matter. But I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk to you guys today, and to continue to work with Cloud and PUD in all Bonneville related matters. So really appreciate it. If you don't mind, Sean, go ahead, just fast forward to the agenda. The agenda is pretty short. I was asked to look at two items today. The first is the post-28 power contract process, and the key word there is process. We're not covering any of the potential substantive issues that might pop up during that process, but, you know, what can we expect over the next, 7 years as Bonneville ramps up to these post-2028 contracts? And then the second agenda item is what I'll say is a very high-level energy imbalance market update. I understand that one or more of the commissioners may have a question or two on the EIM, and I'm more than welcome to being interrupted and taken completely off my slides, and I'll do my best to answer any questions that you might have. And as we get going, just to kind of continue on that theme, my strong preference is to be interrupted during this presentation with questions. I think it'll make for a much better conversation, and I'd rather not just go through the slides without that kind of dialogue. So the first item here is the post-28 contracts and what process can we expect moving forward. And the key thing to know is the district's current contract with Bonneville will continue through September 30th, 2028. So more than 7 years from now, it'll expire. But that being said, Bonneville and customers are now starting to look and consider what those post-28 contracts might look like. And BPA has already found a label for this process. They're calling it the provider of choice process. The last contract was the regional dialogue process. We're now in the provider of choice process, and I included a link to Bonneville's website for this process in the slides. The effort is being headed up by Bonneville's Northwest Requirements Marketing Work Group, and Kim Thompson is the VP of that. So my expectation is that you'll be hearing a lot more from her as we move through time. I think the key thing to think about as we prepare to go through this process is, one, you know, Bonneville and preference customers don't do this very often. The last time we went through the regional dialogue process, it began in 2002 and continued all the way through 2011. But that, you know, is getting to be 15, 20 years ago now. And if you think about it, if Bonneville and customers decide they're going to do another 20-year contract, the next time we'll revisit a lot of these issues won't be until 20 years from now, until 2040 approximately. So this is really a once-in-a-generation and perhaps once-in-two-generation opportunity to look at Bonneville's products, its costs, and the rates that it charges for those products. So it's a big deal, and you can see why it takes 7 to 8 years to really go through the entire process and develop these contracts.
Brian, can I jump in and ask a question?
Please do, yeah.
Well, a couple of things. When the administrator was down at PPC some months ago talking about this, he indicated there might be some variation of the type of contracts, you know, maybe 10-year contracts and so on. You may be going to cover this, or just shut me down if that's the case. But is that still in the works? And the other thing, they were talking about having the – well, I see here. You've already got it up here. 2023 is their rollout for this, the ROD strategy. So go ahead. I guess I just need to wait and be patient.
I'd rather you interrupt me, because I think that'll create more benefit for both you and me. So on the term of the contract, you'll find a lot of divergent views on that, even within public power. There are some folks that feel like a 20-year contract is way too long. It really puts you at the mercy of Bonneville and its rates, and reduces your leverage with the administrator in Bonneville. Others say, no, we want the certainty of a 20-year rate, or not rate, but contract term, and we'd like to do that again to lock in the federal system, so to speak. And so I think to answer your question, as of now, because we're so early in the process, I think the administrator or anybody else would tell you that all options are on the table as far as the term. As we move forward, my expectation is that will get a lot narrower. But for now, nobody's ruled out a 10-year, 5-year, or 20-year term.
So what's your opinion? Is a shorter-term contract more advantageous or not?
You know, I think a 20-year contract with off-ramps, and maybe they'd be at a 5, 10, 15-year interval, would give kind of the benefits of both worlds. I do feel that what we saw in the regional dialogue contract, and I know you knew Terry, and you've been doing this probably longer than I have, is that the regional dialogue contracts went into place fiscal year 2012, and almost immediately there was a high single-digit rate increase, almost like that.
Yeah.
And then we went to the next rate period, and there was another high single-digit rate increase, and for 3 or 4 rate periods in a row, that was the case. Well, now Bonneville sees kind of the end of the current contracts, and so it's made an enormous push to become very cost competitive over the last several rate periods. And the question I would have, why weren't you doing that from the very beginning?
Yeah, exactly.
When people are starting to leave that you start to or have the option to leave that you're starting to worry about that. And so I do see there's some benefit to having always that kind of pressure of, you know, you need to keep an eye on these costs and also on just service in general to make sure that you have happy customers. So I think if I had my druthers, I would say a 20-year contract with off-ramps would be preferable.
Yeah, Ryan and Will, you know, from observing the IPRs for the last year or so and the QBRs and all this kind of stuff and see what Bonneville is doing with money and debt and so forth like that, it's indicative to me that they're trying to look as good as possible on the rates right now as we enter into this contract process period. And so that's why we really got to go into this eyes wide open, because, you know, they're doing the usual, deferring capital expenses on both transmission and power side and stuff like that. And, in modeling things in a different way. So I think that, you know, it really behooves us to pay close attention to the type of contract over the next couple of years that the BPA is putting together for contracts. There's multiple kinds.
Ryan, this is Rick. If the contract is going to allow for rate adjustments through the term of the contract, then it seems to me only fair that we would have off-ramps as well.
Yeah.
So that's my input with respect to off-ramps. I'm assuming Bonneville is going to want the ride or the ability to adjust rates through the term of the contract. But if they get that, then we need off-ramps in case they become uncompetitive or something untoward happens during the term.
Yeah, I agree. And your assumption is absolutely right. So by statute, Bonneville has to adjust its rates no less frequently than every 5 years. Under the current contract, it does so every 2 years, which in my mind is too frequent. It's almost like you're on a constant hamster wheel of the rate cycle. And so I think another area where people are going to be interested in talking with Bonneville is to see if there's a happy medium between 2 and 5 years. I would expect that.
Well, since we're asking questions here, I'll add one more. I guess what's prompted a lot of action from Bonneville is the threat by a number of utilities to go to market and forego Bonneville contracts.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard a couple of presentations on that. It sounds like it, first thing off, people are quoting spot market rates as a justification for that, which, of course, spot market's not going to do much for you in the future. But secondly, that whether or not if you did leave Bonneville, would they take debt with them or not? Are you going to talk about that? Or?
So for this presentation, I focused on the process.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But I think that's an interesting question. And I think just to kind of throw in a little bit of color on that, you know, if, are folks really, truly going to leave Bonneville? I think some are seriously looking at it. I think, though, that a lot of the discussion on whether folks will leave Bonneville happened prior to CETA, which may have changed some of the analysis, at least for Washington utilities.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Everybody was out there looking for an aggregator, and
yep,
that's probably changed. Okay, thank you. I'll shut up now.
No, I was hoping for these questions. But this slide here is a slide prepared by Bonneville on the provider of choice process. And you'll see, you know, we are very early in on the process here in 2021. We are in the concept development, and we're just getting started on that. In fact, Bonneville is expected to hold its first kind of joint Bonneville staff, customer staff workshop on March 18th. And they're holding that through the PPC Rates and Contracts Work Group, but my understanding is that all preference customers, even those that are non-PPC members, are going to be attending that, which I deem to be very appropriate. So that this over the next year or so, we're going to be working on just concepts. We're not even in the policy world yet. We're just in concepts, and that those workshops are going to culminate into a concept paper later this year. And my expectation, there will be multiple opportunities for both unofficial and official comment to Bonneville before the paper comes out. And then once the paper comes out, we're going to start actually developing the policy. And that's going to continue for another 2 years and finally end with a record of decision. And once we have the policy out, all worked out, we'll spend another 2 years actually putting it down in the contract form. And by late 2025, we'll have signed contracts with Bonneville. And so you'll note that's 3 years before actual service takes place under the contracts. And in that intervening 3 years, Bonneville and customers will be taking steps to implement the contracts. So we're ready to go live on October 1, 2028.
Hey, Ryan, the policy workshops that you've indicated here and talked about, mm-hmm, are those public?
So So I think many of them will be public, as in a notice on Bonneville's website for anybody and everybody to come attend. And then I expect that some of them will be run through the PPC Rates and Contracts work group, which again, at least in this initial one, even non-PPC members are invited to attend, and I would hope that that would be the case for the future as well. So I think there'll be a little bit of both.
Ryan, can you describe a little bit for everybody on this call WPAG's role here in supporting us? It's a little different than an association. I'm not sure a lot of people understand that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the opportunity. So kind of background on WPAG. WPAG is a collection of, as of this month, 23 public utilities. So public utility districts, municipalities with their own electric utility. And in fact, we're located chiefly in Washington, but we also have two Oregon utilities. And what we are is a group of public utilities that work together and try to identify areas that we want to focus our advocacy efforts. And my law office serves as special counsel with each of one of those utilities. And so it's a attorney-client relationship rather than an association relationship like WPUDA or PPC, where you're a member of those organizations. Those organizations have bylaws, articles of incorporation, and are a lot different than, you know, that attorney-client privilege and relationship that my law office has with each of the WPAG members. So it's a different arrangement altogether.
Yeah, thank you.
So on this slide here, I took Bonneville's slide on the previous page, and then I also went through the regional dialogue process, the process used to develop the current contracts between 2002 and 2011, and I kind of meshed them together into eight different phases. And I won't go through each phase on this page because in the subsequent pages I thought we could talk about each one and just kind of what they are at a very high level and what the district can expect. So if you don't mind, Sean, next page. So the first one is policy development. And for the last contracts, this lasted over 5 years. And it really started with a letter from a group of preference customers to Bonneville. And it ended with a record decision in 2007. And I won't cover all of the many policy decisions that were made during that process. Yes. But I will mention probably the biggest one. And it's one that's going to continue to pop up as we go through here. It used to be that Bonneville had one power rate, that it provided all of its power to preference customers, and it was a melded rate, and that included the cost of the oldest dam on the system and the newest resource that Bonneville acquired to serve the load of its preference customers. It was all melded into one rate. And in the regional dialogue process, Bonneville said, you know what, we're going to create a tiered system. The tier one will include the federal base system, which is basically all the hydro facilities on the Columbia River system, Energy Northwest, the nuclear facility, and a few other select non-federal resources. That'll be the federal base system or the tier one system. And historically, that has been the cheapest power in the Pacific Northwest. And also, most importantly now today, it's deemed to have very, very low carbon content. The expectation was that low cost moving forward would continue. And the idea would be if your utility's load grew beyond its allocated share of the Tier 1 system, Bonneville could meet that load growth with Tier 2 products. Or you could go out and acquire non-federal resources to meet that load growth yourself. And the expectation was the Tier 1 system would be the low-cost stuff. Everything else to serve your load, in addition to that, would probably be at a higher cost. And that way, your own load growth was shouldered by your utility rather than by being spread across all the other utilities that buy power from Bonneville. It was really trying to place the cost of serving load growth on those that were growing. And that is the that culminated into what's called the tiered rates methodology. And we'll talk about that a number of times here on, you know, hereafter. But that was probably the biggest and most important decision made in the last process. We are right at the beginning of the policy development phase for the upcoming contracts, right at the very start. Bonneville said it started in 2016, but really this is kind of, we're hitting the meat of it right now in 2021. And it too will culminate in, well, it'll have this concept paper at the end of this year, but at the end of it, in late 2023, we can expect a final policy record of decision, which will formalize all of the policy decisions that the administrator will make following this extended process. Any questions on that? There's probably a lot behind that that you might want to talk about.
Ryan, I'm assuming at this point there really hasn't been any discussion about whether they would continue that framework for the new contract.
To me, that is the first question to ask as we head down the policy road. Because once you decide A or B, you know, yes, we'll continue the TRM or not, then we can line up all of the other policy questions behind it like dominoes. But so I think that that is the first question. And I think just listening to kind of the region and the WAPAG utilities, my guess is that we'll probably end up with something like the TRM, if not exactly like the current TRM. And if that's the case, will be focused primarily on making tweaks to the current construct rather than reinventing the wheel or going back to the old wheel. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Good question. Any other questions on the policy piece before we move on? Okay. So after we get through the policy, we actually sit down for about 18 more months and develop the contract templates and the product definitions. So we're going to take what we developed in the policy world and build it into actual products and contracts. And my expectation is that this will include a lot of workshops and drafting meetings. At the end of the day, it'll end up just like in the prior process with another record of decision made by the administrator approving the contract templates. And this will happen towards the end of 2025. Questions on that? Okay. Sean, go ahead. All right. So now, you know, we're in 2025, and now we will actually execute the contracts for post-28. So that will happen probably in November or December of 2025. And note, this is going to be 3 years prior to the date that the district will actually take service under the new contract. And the way this works is if the district signs a 20-year contract in 2025, that 20-year contract will expire itself in 2045. And the district will only take 17 years of actual service under the contract. So, the term starts right when you sign it, but service starts 3 years later.
Well, Ryan, do you anticipate that there would be an off-ramp right at 2028? Because I'm assuming when you sign in 2025 that there will be some rate that you're given, but I can't imagine that Bonneville is going to be able to hold their rate for 3 years.
No, so the current contracts, the regional dialogue contracts, will continue through September 30th, 2028. So we'll continue to take service, or the district will continue to take service under its current contract. And the new service won't start until October 1, 2028. We'll spend that 3 years between the end of 25 and the end of 28 getting ready for the new contracts.
No, I meant with respect to the rate.
So the rate,
you know, you sign a contract in 2025, I'm assuming you have some idea of what the rate's going to be in 2028.
No, we don't.
I don't know how that would work, though.
Yeah, right. Well, let me put it this way. So for the rates through 2028, they'll be set just like they are currently, okay? And though for the rates for anything after 2028, that's a real question, and maybe the next slide will help us on that, or the next couple slides. But the way it'll work is we will either contemporaneously with the development of the contracts, so that phase two, or if we follow the process that Bonneville used in the regional dialogue contracts, immediately after execution of the contracts, Bonneville and customers will actually sit down and develop a rate methodology, right, that will be implemented post 28. And that will be itself formally accepted by the administrator through another record of decision. Now that methodology will not be applied until we set rates for the first term or rate period of the new contract. So there will be some uncertainty as to what those rates will look like. And in fact, we can also reflect back on the transition from the contracts prior to the current ones. So the first rate year under the current contracts was fiscal year 2012. And there was a three-year rate case that preceded that, where we actually developed the rates under the tiered rate methodology, which itself wasn't finalized at the time when we were in the middle of this rate case. And so when we finally went through, finalized the rate methodology, went through the rate case, we saw that significant jump in rates of about 8%, 6 to 8%. And that was a function of a transition from this melded rate to a tiered rate in a lot of ways. And so there, you're right. There will be some uncertainty when we hit that transition period.
Well, Ryan, I think this is kind of the main point, and part of what Rick's getting at too, is that these contracts really don't set the rate. It's the rate cases process that sets that up and through the FERC process, I guess. And so your rates actually they can be quite, I mean, there is no guarantee on rates, none whatsoever. And whatever you sign, you don't really sign for a contract with a rate, as far as I understand it, at least.
That's right. You're agreeing to a methodology on how your rates will be determined. That's the primary thing that you're getting out of it. There's always been efforts, and my guess is that since the beginning of Bonneville, there's been an effort on Public Power's part to try to get more influence on how Bonneville fixes its costs, for example. And out of these requests, you have things like the integrated program review, the capital investment review, and so forth, which were all designed as a way to allow preference customers and transmission customers to give Bonneville more input when it sets its cost prior to going into the rate case. And so my guess is another area that you'll see a lot of push from customers as we move through the policy process is to try to gain even more avenues and control over how Bonneville sets its costs. Because that's one way you can help kind of control that rate impact to you.
So it's really important then for the rates is to focus on what are Bonneville's costs at each iteration of a rate case, whatever that process is set up to do.
That's one of the big pieces, yeah. I mean, there are other things that influence Bonneville's rates in addition to costs, but that's one area that Bonneville and customers can control.
So the logic of the tiered system was that the hydro system was fully subscribed, and so if you took tier two from Bonneville, some of that, or if not all of that, would come from market purchases. Is that right?
So
basically, your costs, your rates, if you're over the tier one limit, and I'm not sure how that's going to be restructured yet, but again, your rates would be dependent on what market rates were doing as well.
The expectation is that Bonneville would acquire the output of a resource, whether it was through the market or maybe directly from a resource, that it would come from, Bonneville contracting with somebody else to serve that load or have the power to serve that load. And so, yeah, you're right.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Ryan, this is Doug.
Yeah, please.
Yeah, How has any further thoughts or maybe your thoughts on how CETA and resource adequacy and EIM all impacts all of this? There's a lot going on.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces, right? And it's hard to nail that down. I think you've hit on one of the – there's maybe four or five areas that I think are going to have a lot of attention, and just carbon is one of the biggest, if not the biggest. You're going to have several different themes that you'll see. One is Washington has CETA. Nobody else in the – none of the other four states in the Pacific Northwest have CETA. Oregon's trying to get something like it, isn't there yet. Idaho and Montana have a completely different view on carbon than Washington does. And so if you think of this one system and you have utilities across the region taking power from Bonneville, the Washington utilities are going to want the carbon output of the system to be as low or as close to zero as possible. And they may be willing to pay a premium to achieve it. You'll have other utilities, maybe in Idaho or Montana, that are less concerned about the carbon content of the power and are unwilling to pay a premium so that Bonneville is closer to a zero carbon content resource. And so there will be tension amongst preference customers on how to manage that. And there may be ways to do that within a tiered construct or not, but that'll be one of the areas of consideration. And it just kind of shows some of the fault lines that we can expect the discussion to have. So I think, one, Bonneville's fully aware of the CETA obligations, and I think the region and Bonneville are all going to have to try to sit down and figure out how to solve that and keep everybody satisfied. And so I don't have much more than that. But.
Brian, this is Rick.
Yeah.
When Bonneville sets its rates, it sets them – I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they set them on their cost. Not on necessarily the value. You were making an argument, it seemed to me, about the value with respect to CETA. But when Bonneville sets that rate, it's with respect to their cost, not the value.
Yeah, I think I muddled my message. You're absolutely right. It's on the cost. But to the extent Bonneville needs to go out and do balancing purchases, right? And if those balancing purchases have to be low carbon or zero carbon content resources, it may end up paying a premium for those, and that premium will be passed through to customers as a cost. Yeah.
Good point.
I hope that helps clarify.
Now, at PPC, I don't know, a year or so ago, Elliot made a commitment to provide an analysis of the impact of joining EIM on preference customers. Financial analysis, I would hope. Did that ever happen? I haven't seen anything like that, so I don't know if Mr. Hairston is carrying that on or not.
So it did happen, and I have a section on EIM, but let's just talk about it now. This is perfect time.
Well, no, you can defer it. That's fine.
Let me answer it. So they had an E3 study done.
Oh, yeah.
And that identified as much as $40 million per year of benefit to Bonneville by joining the EIM. But there's a lot of caveats to that. And so that's kind of let's save that for the EIM discussion. That's kind of just a leader on that.
Okay. Ryan, one more thing with the secondary income from that Bonneville gets. Mm-hmm. Subtracts from our costs. Is that still continuing? Or they talked for a while about doing away with that. Is that so? If all that resource adequacy and EIM, if it all impacts the cost of the secondary, it seems like that would be a positive to us.
Yeah. I mean that's one of the main reasons Bonneville would join the EIM is it would increase its secondary sales revenue, which,
right,
as you pointed out, currently is an offset of Bonneville's costs and lowers the overall rate that you pay for the Tier 1 system. And thus far, Bonneville has not gotten rid of that yet. That construct is still in place as it historically has been in place.
Okay. Nice.
But that construct may be a topic that Bonneville wants to talk about for the post-28 dialogue. So it's not necessarily settled for post-28 at all.
Right. Thank you.
Ryan, maybe you have another slide about this, but that three-year period before 2028, where did I get this right? We sign a contract in 2025, but there's a three-year implementation process. But looking at some of your notes on this slide, it looks like there's still a lot of decisions to be made. Why does that have to be a three-year period that we sign? And then why did it take 3 years? And then B, what are we really doing in there in that 3 years that may cause us to have second questions or second guess what we just signed?
Right. Well, that is a risk that I, in my view, somewhat came back and bit preference customers from the last contract round, is that 3 year lag. But we're on that slide. It's a great question. The reason for the 3 year lag in the prior process was that one of the expectations was, hey, preference customers, we're going to lock in the tier one system, but we may serve our load growth either through Bonneville or, and this was the expectation, non-federal resources acquired directly by your utility. And so the idea coming out of the regional dialogue contracts is, hey, we need that 3 years to really figure out how we're going to serve our load once the new contracts go in place. And I think the 3 years under the provider of choice process that Bonneville outlined in its timeline, it has most likely a similar idea behind it. We'll probably find out more as we get further into the process. The other thing that happened during that time period is, you know, Bonneville set the size of the tier one system. It wasn't going to grow it anymore, but it had to allocate the current system then among all of its preference customers. And so it had to develop a methodology to do that. And that's called the contract high watermark process. And the way they established it is they looked at everybody's loads and individual resources. And I think it was in 2010. So they looked at your 2010 loads and resources. It may have been 2009. And so you had to have a whole year under your belt looking at this. And then they based off of that, they allocated the system between all of Bonneville's preference customers. And to me, that's another huge question heading into the next contracts is, hey, are we going to keep the same contract high watermarks that we established for the current contracts? Or are we going to acknowledge that some utilities have changed in their circumstance? Maybe their load has grown. Maybe they've gained or lost a resource. And should we reshuffle the deck? And I can tell you, if we reshuffle the deck and keep the tier one system the same size or similarly situated as it is now, there will be winners and losers in a reshuffle. And I think this will be an area of significant discussion within public power.
Ryan, this is Rick. I'm following up on what Jim said. My gut tells me that 3 years is more than time than they need for this contract. I can understand it for the previous contract because it seems to me like they had to create some wheels and some methodologies that they didn't have. Now we've got some of those in place. Yeah, we may tweak them, but I feel much more comfortable signing a contract with only a year out to go or a year and a half rather than 3 years.
Yeah. I think you make a good point, Rick. I don't dispute that at all. And I think there's some real advantage to waiting as well as we get into my later slides, because I think there's at least one enormous policy cost decision that will need to be made that you would hate to sign a contract and find out it went the wrong way for you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, Sean, yeah. So phase five, we kind of already talked about this. You know, before we had the prior process, we were coming up with this tiered rate methodology. And that took at least 4 years to do it. Note that it was after the contracts were signed for a good portion of it. So again, here to your point, we were developing a rate methodology for a contract we've already signed. And therefore, the outcome of that process in developing the rate methodology, we lost the ability to say no if we didn't like the outcome. Bonneville anticipates that we'll have to go through a similar process to develop a rate methodology. If we keep the TRM, my guess is there'll be tweaks to it, if we decide to get rid of the TRM, we're going to have to come up with a whole new methodology. Right now, Bonneville anticipates that the development of the rate methodology for the post-28 contracts will happen contemporaneously with the development of the contract templates, which is probably the right way to go. You certainly wouldn't want a situation where you waited like you did before. But remember, what happened in the 2007-2011 timeframe was a recession, a rather significant one. And so when they started development of the TRM, they went in with certain assumptions about loads and resources for the region. And then about 2008, 2009, a lot of people right in that test year for determining contract high watermarks lost a lot of load, which if you had stuck with that would have left them with a much smaller share of the tier one system than they normally would have gotten under normal load circumstances. And so they reopened the tiered rates to account for that change in circumstances so that people could retain some of what they would have had absent the recession. And that could obviously happen again. Then the next phase here is the residential exchange program. I'm not sure how much detail you want me to go in on this, but the residential exchange is a statutory program under the Northwest Power Act. It's essentially a subsidy from preference customers to the investor-owned utilities. And the investor-owned utilities take that subsidy and they provide it to their residential and small firm customers. One of the chief things that Bonneville wanted to accomplish in the last contract was to settle its residential exchange program. It was the source of continuous litigation and a huge headache for Bonneville and I think for a lot of other folks in the region. And so just prior to the very first year of the current contracts, Bonneville settled the residential exchange. And so basically, it's a straight payment from preference customers to Bonneville that Bonneville then funnels to the IOUs. Your current rates include $245 million per year of residential exchange settlement costs. Starting in fiscal year 2022, I think it increases to $259 million. That settlement will expire at the end of the current contract, so September 30th, 2028. And so one of the big questions is, what will the residential exchange look like in the new contract period? Will there be a settlement, or absent a settlement, how will Bonneville implement the statutory program? This is a huge unknown and a very with a huge dollar amount associated with it. And again, recognize what happened last time. We signed our contracts in, 2008. We did not settle the residential exchange until 2011. And so we did not know what that was going to look like. And it was a huge uncertainty with signed contracts that you're already committed to. And I think that speaks again to Rick's earlier point. Maybe we shouldn't sign 3 years in advance. Maybe we should get this resolved before we sign. I think that's a fair point.
Do you anticipate that CETA will have an impact on REP?
I think it could, very much so. I think there's a risk that could happen, yes. And not a positive way for preference customers.
Yeah, well, I mean, the way I was thinking about it is that, you know, if we're trying to make them on a level playing field, the private utilities in Washington could seem like they could make an argument that they have a higher cost than those of the other states.
I've been thinking the same thing, Rick. The last two phases here, I think they're fairly self-explanatory. Phase seven would be the first rate case under the new contract. And so this will happen right before the new contract starts to take service. And indeed, this is where, you know, a lot of the rate precedent will be set for the duration of the new contract. And so it's probably going to be the more onerous and involved rate case under the new contracts just because it'll be everyone's first chance to argue about the new methodology. And so that'll be a very important rate case. And then finally, October 1 is when the new contracts and service will actually take place. So, you know, this is my last slide on this. You know, where are the engagement opportunities for Clallam PUD and any other public utility? I think first and foremost, it's through your account executive. My understanding is that the executives, account executives, have already been reaching out and had an ongoing dialogue with the preference customers they work with. The next phase would be kind of those formal processes or points in the process, workshops, drafting sessions, filing formal comments, settlement discussions, if any. So for the residential exchange, if there's settlement discussions, I would consider that just part of the whole overall contract process. Participation in trade organizations like WAPEG and WAPUTA, et cetera. And then finally, you know, a lot of this is between Bonneville's preference customers, you know, who are all differently situated. Some live in Washington, some live in Montana, Idaho, Oregon. Some are east side, some are west side utilities. There are a whole host of different perspectives and concerns. And I think the understanding what other preference customers need and want from their contracts will be important for Clallam and any other utility involved in the process. And so I think engaging and having a dialogue with other BPA customers is probably just as important as dealing with Bonneville itself.
On residential exchange, are there controls in place to prevent something like the Judy Johansson debacle of some time back?
You know, well, Terry Munder is going to come talk to our group, WAPEG, on Thursday of this week on the residential exchange.
Oh, good, good.
Can you save that question for him?
I will. He probably remembers those. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. That one was a little bit before me. So any other question on the process?
Good presentation, Ryan.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Okay. Well, I don't know how much detail you guys wanted on the energy imbalance market, so I actually kept it at a very high level and was hoping you would just ask me the questions you want answers to, and I'll do my best to answer them. So I'll go through these slides. You probably know most of it, but please ask the questions you have, and we'll go from there. So in September of 2019, Bonneville signed an implementation agreement with the CAISO and a record decision, and the decision was to move forward towards joining the Western Energy Imbalance Market in March or April of 2022. And that signing of the implementation agreement marked the close of what's known as phase two of Bonneville's five-phase EIM decision-making process. We are currently in phase four, which is the BP22 and TC22 process, where Bonneville's developing the rates and tariff provisions to actually join the EIM. If you go to the next slide, please. You know, what is an EIM? For those that don't know, it's a centralized voluntary market that provides sub-hourly economic dispatch of participating resources for balancing supply and demand every 5 minutes. And it does so respecting transmission and reliability constraints. This little table here shows, you know, kind of the difference between an EIM and a non-EIM participant. So without an EIM, Bonneville, as a transmission balancing authority, would have to balance the loads and resources within its balancing authority in real time, all by itself using its own resources and loads. An EIM allows multiple balancing authority areas to share loads and resources to have a more efficient dispatch. And the idea is that, you know, one, lowers everybody's costs to balance loads and resources. And most importantly for Bonneville, it feels it opens up a new market for Bonneville to sell surplus power to other utilities. And so Bonneville is looking at this as a potential source of new revenue. And that's here. And then I think, Will, this gets back to your earlier question. So when Elliot came and talked to you before, E3 had done a study that said, hey, Bonneville joins the EIM, it could see annual benefits in excess of $40 million. And Bonneville took this E3 study into a record of decision, and they made a number of more conservative assumptions, and they whittled that down to, you know, approximately $29 to $34 million a year of expected benefit. And the idea is that this additional revenue should lower Bonneville's power rates to preference customers as a new secondary revenue stream. And it also has a number of transmission benefits, as indicated on the other side.
Well, there are a lot of problems, concerns about joining EIM. First, EIM board, it's California-centric, as Cal ISO is.
Mm-hmm.
I think we were successful in getting at least one public power appointment to that board. But having said that, if you had a suspicious mind, Elliot was pushing this very heavily, and he goes down to and becomes CEO of Cal ISO. Should I be suspicious?
You know, I don't think you'd be alone if you are. I think that is a concern, and it's one that, you know, California's problems during the summer definitely have opened some more eyes on that.
Yeah, the governor of California appoints all the board members to Cal ISO, so.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that there's always a concern when you have a market like this that has a primary directive to benefit one state participating in the market, and that's what the CAISO has.
Yeah, especially if that state is California.
Yeah, yeah, and so I think it's fair to be suspicious.
Can I chime in a little bit, please? I have a trading background in the electric utility industry, and there were a number of times when I would see what was going on at the energy imbalance market, and I would be long and wishing I could sell into it. Mm-hmm. What we have to remember is this is voluntary.
Yep.
Bonneville is only going to sell into it when they're long. And there are times when the energy imbalance market just goes through the roof. And I think it's great that Bonneville has the opportunity to take advantage of that when it makes sense.
I don't disagree with that either. I think there's room for both views and a little bit of caution when you deal with the CAISO. You'll see in my conclusion that I don't think there's much anybody could do to stop Bonneville from joining the EIM, given all the investment over the last 3 years towards that step. That being said, I am aware that SPP just came and gave a presentation on a similar market that they're starting up, and found a lot of people interested eyes in the Northwest. So, you know, I think it's yet to be determined, but I think it'll be hard for Bonneville to not take that step.
Ryan, does the benefit, supposedly, the money, this $38 million or whatever that Bonneville makes, or the cost, does that translate equally to the different kinds of contracts that BPA customers have, like, in other words, a block or slice or load following? Does everybody basically end up equal risk and opportunity, or is there differences between the different kinds of?
Oh, there's definitely differences. So Highland PD, I believe you're a load following customer. You will likely see very little to no difference the day before and after Bonneville joins the EIM. The cost and credits that will flow to Bonneville will go to power services. Let me say that again. The cost and credits related to you as a load following utility will flow to power services, and power services will shoulder those on your behalf. And so you'll have that buffer of power services between you and the EIM. If you were a slice block customer, your circumstances would be much different. You would directly see the costs and credits that flow through the EIM based on your load. So differently situated utilities based on the product they receive from Bonneville will see the EIM either directly or not at all, or indirectly, I guess, through power rates. So,
Ryan,
yeah.
You go to PPC meetings. How is PPC leaning or feeling about the EIM?
I think So PBC has invested a great deal of time and treasure getting familiar with the CAISO and kind of starting to participate in its processes. So I think you will see that I don't think they would say this, but they see that the likelihood of Bonneville will join the EIM is pretty close to a certainty as well. And because of that, they are becoming more active in CAISO almost on a daily basis. I think the one area that in the rate case, the current ongoing rate case where PBC is pushed back on Bonneville is something kind of interesting. So we identified that, what was it, 28, 30 some odd million dollars of benefit that Bonneville expects if it joins the EIM per year. Well, Bonneville will join the EIM in March or April of 2022, which will be 6 months into the BP22 rate period. And Bonneville is saying, well, you know, we know we said that we would see $34 million of benefit from joining the EIM when we decided to sign the implementation agreement. But for purposes of setting BP22 rates, we're going to assume that we're only going to receive $3.4 million per year of additional revenue by joining the EIM, which, by the way, offsets the cost that we expect from joining the EIM. So the net benefit is zero in setting rates. Those two things seem to be in conflict. PBC definitely submitted some testimony pushing back on that assumption. You know, if it's good enough to sign the implementation agreement that you're going to receive $30 million of additional benefit, then it should be good enough for setting rates and allow the preference customers to benefit from that.
Thank you.
So, Ryan, what's your opinion? Do we see more involvement of Bonneville in CAISO in the future?
So I think that, to Rick's point, it's voluntary. One of the things that you'll hear Bonneville say is that it has had a harder time trading with its traditional trading partners because they're all in the EIM and it's not. And so it feels somewhat isolated and doesn't have the same opportunity it may have had in the past. And so, one, I think it feels like it needs to join the EIM to kind of gain back some of that, some of the trading partners it normally has. Well, two, I think that there's some real value that Bonneville can make with its low carbon content power selling into the EIM. And that additional revenue would offset our rates. And three, I just think that that once Bonneville gets in there, that's just a baby step into the CAISO. The next step that Bonneville will look at is what's called the extended day ahead market. Currently, CAISO has a day ahead market that's only available for California market participants. It's currently in the process of developing an extended day-ahead market that would expand to other parts of the West. And although that rollout has been slowed down by COVID and the wildfires, as time marches through, you know, I think that will become more and more of a possibility, and Bonneville will continue to look at that very hard.
Yeah, I think the comment that comes back from PPC was that this is kind of the thin end of the wedge of getting into CAISO. Mm-hmm. And the analogy was made that it's just like Hotel California. You can check out, but you can never leave.
Yeah, I think my favorite one that I've heard, and I know it's an old one, is all roads lead to an RTO.
Yeah, exactly. That's right.
Just to give you another perspective, it's just, gives Bonneville a bigger market
mm-hmm.
to sell their power. And California has, that they often have a large demand and therefore much more significant prices in the secondary market than we see in the Northwest. Frankly, I see it as a win-win.
Yeah, Rick, you know, another interesting part of that is, you know, during the day with all of California solar, they have a lot of energy that they sell pretty cheap. That we could buy up, you know, California, they could sell to us.
Right. I'm not saying that that won't happen, and that would be good for us too.
Yeah.
But there are times when the sun don't shine and they need power, and prices can be 3 or 4 or 5 times what they are in the Northwest in the secondary market.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's opportunities and risks on all sides, and it's just it's tough to take that step.
Yeah, but remember, it's voluntary. Nothing's making Bonneville sell to California.
Yeah, I think the Hotel California analogy is one is apt. You know, once Bonneville checks in, can it really check out? if it says voluntary, it says voluntary. But sometimes it's harder for Bonneville to extract itself than meets the eye, and that's the concern for a lot of folks, I think.
Mm-hmm. But Ryan, right now, I mean, we buy and sell power between California and CAISO right now. It's just that this EIM is focused on shorter term balancing, I think.
Correct. That's correct.
I'm correct. Okay. The second point is, if BPA's customers were all load following customers, would there be an imbalance?
Yeah. Energy imbalance is, you know, you forecast what the load's going to be the day before, assuming, you know, you have a day ahead market. Now, most load is driven by weather. And we all know that weather forecasts are off. And when your weather forecast says it's going to be 60 and it comes in at 55 or 65, load is significantly different. And that's what you need the real-time market for.
Yeah. I mean, Bonneville does this now. It just does it for itself. You know, balancing loads and resources, which are always fluctuating. And so here's just a way to expand the footprint of sharing loads and resources to meet those imbalances and do it in a more efficient manner.
And this requires a very a very fast response rate on the resource itself, because it's inefficient, the EIM will make more money.
Ryan, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Typically in the real-time market, it closes at 20 minutes to the hour. So as you're looking at what your loads were doing the last 4, 5, 6 hours, it really gives you a good indication what's going to happen in the next hour. So that gives you the opportunity to either go out and sell because you may be long, and you may have a resource hydro where you're having to force the water down the river for whatever reason, then that gives you a place to go out and sell that. Or if you're short because you under-forecasted your loads or you had a resource drop off unexpectedly, then it gives you the opportunity to fill in that gap. Does that help?
Rick, I appreciate that. That's on the load side. I'm just wondering what the resource is generating.
Yeah, that's what the resource is. You know, hydro is really unique in its ability to ramp up and ramp down instantaneously.
Well, if it can do that, why is there so much imbalance?
Well, because maybe you've got constraints on your hydro system that says that you can't push out any more water because of nitrogen or gases in the downstream of the dam. Maybe it's your upper limit on the hydro and you have no other resources.
Well, that's the opposite of flexibility. So,
right.
It is
the opposite of flexibility that is often caused by fish constraints.
So we can move on to the next slide. It was interesting. I was looking at each of your bios before today's call. And I said to myself, there's a good chance that somebody's going to ask a question that I can't answer, but one of these other guys will be able to do it. You know, with two engineers and another person with over 30 years of experience, this is a fun conversation. If you could go to the next slide, that'd be great. So here's Bonneville's current timeline for the EIM. We're right in the middle of what's phase 4 there on the top there. Notice the green, Bonneville, you know, we have these public power or these BPA processes underway, but at the meantime, Bonneville's working with CAISO, marching towards implementation in March of 22. The final decision whether to join the EIM, so that has not had been made yet, will be in September of this year. At the end of September, the administrator will make that final decision. you know, final concluding remarks. You know, we haven't joined the IN yet. A final decision will be made in September. You know, but meanwhile, Bonneville's marching forward as if it is going to join the EIM. It's getting those rates and tariff provisions in place to do so if it decides to join. You know, I think it would be extraordinary if Bonneville didn't join the EIM, given everything it's invested in it. But at the same time, my understanding is that in the early 2000s, Bonneville had a very similar process to joining RTO West, and even said it was going to join, and then ultimately decided not to do so. So I could always be surprised. Load following customers like Kyle and PUD, I don't expect that you'll notice much of a difference. There may be a some, but most of that's going to be, you're going to have Bonneville Power Services as a buffer from the direct implications of the market. And in the long term, you know, I think that, that this is just one step towards more interaction with the EIM or the CAISO, and that will probably lead to other market opportunities with CAISO as we move forward in time. That's my presentation for today. I think I went a little over time. I apologize about that.
Thank you. Lots of questions.
I'm sorry, what was that? Is there other questions or comments?
Good job, Ryan.
Yeah, Ron, that was a great presentation. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, guys.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you, Ryan.
Okay, under business items, our next item, since we're, will be Rick's item on making a request to staff to draft a resolution supporting the Snake River Dams. So we can move on to that. Rick, did you have more on that?
When I ran for this position, I had two planks: keep rates as low as possible and make sure Bonneville had enough resources to meet their load. I believe that keeping the Snake River Dams in place supports both of those ventures, and that's why I'm proposing.
Okay, well, I disagree with that, and I think that I would propose that we do a resolution to get rid of them because they are too expensive. They're not a flexible resource. They don't have peaking power, not to mention the biological problems, and they're 40% more cost. They cost more, 40% more than the average main stem dam. So they got a lot of problems. So I'm not sure why we would, certainly not endorse them, and we ought to be telling BPA we don't want to put any more money on them.
Well, having said that, what this resolution would do would just bring us into alignment with the majority of utilities, especially public power. Right now, we're something of an outlier. Let me finish, Jim. It's not going to have any effect because what Clallam PUD thinks is not a big consideration, but... Anyway, go ahead,
I've looked at almost every one of those resolutions since the first one from Grays Harbor, and they're full of misleading statements, facts, and stuff that is just a lot of wrong stuff. And so one follows on after another, and so like a bunch of lemmings, people are lining up and jumping onto these things, and they're not doing any kind of analysis. They're not looking. So if we're going to do this, I think we need to put a serious effort into the staff and look at the documentation, the real documentation out there, not the stuff just coming out of some, you know, Northwest River Partners or something. And let's look into this thing. Let's really look under the hood of the cost of these dams. Let's look at the revenue stream on these dams. Let's look at secondary sales. What are they doing over the last 9 years? They've been losing money pretty much. So when you start adding all this stuff up, that's what the true story is. And so I don't – just because other PUDs are signing up this stuff is not a good reason to do it.
Well, back when we were members of PPC, there was a lot of discussion on this, and I would challenge your statement that there was no analysis done by the people that have actually passed these resolutions. But okay,
that's the very thing that I gave PPC was a peak power paper 5 hours before they expelled us. So, you know, me trying to present and point out where they were wrong just got us in trouble, got me in trouble. So, you know, this they do some analysis, yes, but I'll tell you what, it's not looking deep into this stuff. They're not using the empirical data. They're and it's not just them. There's a lot of other folks saying this stuff too that is just not right. And so if we're going to do this, we better do it right, because we don't need to be signing up to resolutions that are just because somebody else did.
Well, you know, I was on the executive committee of PPC for a number of years. I guess I have more confidence that they expelled us because you came up with a differing opinion. But anyway, I agree with Rick. I think we should put this resolution forward and get staff working on it. Does staff need any more direction than we've given, than Rick's given so far? Doug,
we can put something out there and let you review it and get your comments on it and put it forward to you.
Okay, great. All right, well, let's do that. You've got direction from two commissioners, so. And that'll be brought up at a future meeting for lengthy discussion, I'm sure.
Okay. Just note for the record that I'm objecting. I think we ought to look at both. We ought to say, let's look at a resolution to breach these dams, and another one. If you want to look at one keeping them, fine, and compare them. Let's you know, lay the facts out.
Well, the cost and staff time to do that, and the benefit, I mean, basically, it's not going to affect Clallam PUD, and that's what we're really interested in to any great degree, whether the dams stay or go.
Well, it makes a big difference in terms of what BPA's costs are. So that is a big concern for us. But on the other hand, you say it won't make any difference what we say. So you basically not make any sense.
Didn't the EIS spend about 3 or 4 years studying this and come up with a recommendation?
Yes, and that EIS is going to be thrown out.
All right.
Because it's full of misleading information.
Okay. Well.
Fine, Will.
All right. Good. Let's just move forward. I think. Anyway, we'll have a lengthy discussion on this when the resolution comes before us.
Okay,
sure. Okay, moving on to commissioner reports. Rick, do you have anything? Or?
Yes, sir. I would like to explain my actions at the last meeting. I had a blood clot on my brain. And since the last meeting, I've been in the hospital and been under medication, and now we have the blood clot under control. But I wanted to apologize if I offended anyone and just wanted to give you a heads up on my health.
No apology necessary, Rick. I think we all have experienced little health problems here and there, and big health problems, as a matter of fact.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling better, Rick. Good to have you back.
Yeah, you seem to be fully recovered. That's great. Welcome back. Jim, do you have something?
Oh, boy. It's been a month, right, since our last
meeting? Yeah, it's been a long time.
This is going to be a bit – I'll try to condense this as much as possible since it's a month of stuff. But first off, WAPUTA had meetings on the 17th, 18th, and 19th. They were a combination of commissioner training and normal committee meetings and the board meeting. We had a pretty good discussion on Public Records Act and all that kind of stuff, the Public Meetings Act and so forth. Some good conversations about minutes. I thought it was interesting that this attorney that was given this presentation said that there is no provision for what must be in or out of minutes, and that middle of the road is best. And in fact, there's no rule that you've got to use Robert's rules or anything like that. And so the middle of the road kind of approach is best. And I think that's what we've been trying to do over the last couple of years or 3 years or whatever, is to try to figure out what makes the most sense. But I don't know. We've got recorded meetings now, so that helps a lot. Let's see. the board meeting, there was some, there was the energy meeting had a lot to do about legislation, and maybe you want to cover that, Rick, but I guess my view is it's been a month, and a lot of that legislative stuff has gotten stale now over the last 30 days. I'm going to skip that. The board meeting, dealt again with a lot of the legislation. Also, there was a fair amount of discussion at this meeting and also the WAPAG meeting. WAPAG actually did a presentation on the Congressman Simpson's plan to spend $33 billion to mitigate a bunch of stuff and maybe breach the Snake River dams in 10 years. So there was some comment on that, WAPAG got into a pretty good last week, I guess it was, a presentation on this, and Ryan was trying to go through slide by slide and try, kind of make sense of this stuff. And I had to point out to him after a few minutes is that what we're seeing in Simpson's proposal with this legislation for this $33 billion is a very complex mix of stewed up different pieces of ideas and concepts that from a legislative standpoint with the U.S. Congress and Senate, this is not something that's practical or reasonable or achievable in any kind of time frame in a matter of a year or two. They're talking about the climate and infrastructure bill perhaps, and it's not going to fit into that or anything else. I'm familiar with some of these laws that they're dealing with, having worked with the Corps of Engineers, and you just don't change these things in a matter of months or even a couple of years. I also note that, and you guys saw it, WAPAG sent out a joint piece of work with PPC and themselves and others on the legislative aspects of Simpson's plan, and pretty much have said the same thing. They've got 8 pages of, pretty detailed explanation as to why these things are very difficult to, or the complexities involved with these legislative components. And it's not just one piece of legislation. It's a dozens of different things that would have to be fixed to get this Simpson's plan to work. The one thing that did come out in that walk, the materials we got from the group, WAPAG, PPC, and so forth, is at the end they kind of got off on the litigation and talked about what was going on there with the federal courts in the last 20 years. And they used the term that because the dams are mandated, the courts were not going to push the Corps to breach the dams. And what people keep, and I don't know why they keep saying that, but the authorizations for the dam does not mandate them at all. These authorizations are permissive in nature, and what that means is if the appropriations, or in this case, Bonneville Power money is there to fund them, then they can be, and they must be in conformance with all other laws like the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Water Act. And so this constant, and they pointed out in this paper that you guys got Friday, is that it creates a circular argument. And so you got one law pitted against another law that creates a circular argument. And this is just not the way the real authorizations work here. And so what's important for BPA and PUDs and our customers to realize is because those dams aren't mandated, nor is BPA mandated to pay for them. In fact, they make those kind of funding decisions every day to, downgrade or do something. And so the last thing we need, particularly going into 20-year contracts, is the idea that we are locked into mandated projects and that we can't really adjust. And we have all the flexibility in the world. The Corps has the flexibility. And so I think that's the main thing about Simpson's bill and the spinoff from that. The other thing that Nicholas Garcia was the systems analysis work group of the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, and he gave a presentation on what they're starting to see with the Genesis model, which is this is the model that balances, it looks at all the resources and loads and tries to figure out the optimization of the BPA system and how it might connect with the outside world, which this latest model does a better job of. He had, I had him on my screen here a minute ago, the slides and so forth, that talked about this. And I guess I will try to just go from memory, since my screen is covered with different slide presentations, is that the takeaways that he was giving is that basically resources and loads are sort of in balance for the next few years anyway, and that what the model is showing is where we're showing loss of load probability increases are mostly driven by small problems in the grid itself, moving power around within the BPA authorization area. But it's also, in Nicholas's presentation, important to realize is that there's a lot of complex moving pieces in this, and the models are still, you know, they're coming out with a new model runs this week that will be discussed this week. And so I think it's important to pay attention to what's going on in the eighth power plan as it's evolving now through this process. So, and one thing that I think people, you know, when Nicholas said there'll be a 47% loss of load probability, that was that number was mistaken. As say, a lot of people thought we were going to have a 47% chance of loss of load probability. No, that's not the case. It just meant that we're going to go up a little bit. And the fact that loss of load is not a blackout, it's just some sort of urgent or emergency situation where we have to look at new bringing in additional resources, doing demand, reducing demand, none of which, of course, BPA's resource program even says they're going to use. They're not going to use demand response, and the loads are basically flat over the next 2 years. The QBR, Bonneville Power's QBR, both a tech group and a normal QBR was done since the last meeting. The quarterly business report, basically, this is the first quarter, basically their situation financially looks good. There's no problem with the reserves and so forth, and that's because they had some pretty good revenue streams in September and October, or August and September. There was some slides about capital spending, particularly, especially in the transmission area. And I guess the one thing that for us we should note is that they're reducing capital expenditures on the transmission side over the next several years. And this could be being cynical, you know, a little bit about what we're heading into with this new contract is they're reducing capital spending to keep their reserves looking good. But on the other hand, the transmission system is the weak link in our system right now, both in terms of loss of load probability and for us out here in Clallam County, is the fact that we've got a BPA line that needs a lot of attention too, and we're starting to see some effort in that regard. The other thing that they talked about was another program for cost, dealing with cost issues at BPA, is a strategic cost management planning system. And they spent some time going over that, and it's all got kind of metrics about, you know, how things are going and so forth. And actually this is, you know, it's kind of interesting because this is different than their asset management strategy that they started last year, looking at cost, you know, at the very detailed level, thousands of assets. And I guess what was kind of tough here for any of us looking at all this is that they're pouring on more and more consultation and consultants and planning processes to try to, you know, tweak these costs and so forth. And yet they still aren't willing or able to do part of its ability because they don't know how to really check the cost of each of these assets, I mean the dams. They still aren't looking project by project across those dams and coming up with a asset cost per asset and revenue stream on each of those dams, which is really what you need to do. And until they do that, there won't be much real serious attempt at cost control, I don't think. Let me correct that. They had a lot of serious work and a lot of good work going into cost control, but they're really working the margins of the issue. I guess the other thing, last thing I did was on the 24th, Forks Chamber, Business Chamber of Commerce, I attended their meeting. They were appreciative of our efforts to get BPA out there clearing the easement for the trees and so forth. So good work, staff, on that. And Colleen McAleer gave a really good presentation on the various things she was trying to do and keep businesses going in Clallam County. Are, of course, these are our rate-paying customers. She did a pretty good presentation about how things are, how she's helping the east end of, or the west end of the, of our district. And that's all I've got for the moment. Sorry. Took so long.
Oh, good report, Jim. Thank you. You're going to be surprised, Jim, but I agree with you on that Simpson proposal. There's too many moving parts. You have to unwind a lot of legislation. There's conflicting interest groups that have stake in what happens there. That to me, the 35-year moratorium on litigation, I don't even think that would work. So I don't know what Representative Simpson is after. Maybe it's kind of a political stunt, but being in Idaho, I'm not even sure that's going to work for him. But anyway, it just seems very complex. We're spending a lot of wheels analyzing it. I know PPC is looking at it, WAPEX looking at it, and with other groups, NRU. Anyway, so I'm in agreement with you, Jim.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay, well, what did I do? After our last meeting, we had the Nuclear Safety Review Board at Energy Northwest convene. That's a panel of experts they bring in quarterly, and they go through the plan from soup to nuts, do interviews, look at all of the reports, and try to identify where the weaknesses are. And basically, their job is to be critical. It's not to be complimentary. Although, we did get a lot of compliments on being I can't use the term, a trade group top performer. We're number one with a few other utilities of nuclear plants in the country. So that was a real plus. I went to the kickoff meeting, or I didn't go to it, unfortunately, but I attended virtually the kickoff meeting where they talk about all the items they're going to look at and get reports from department heads and quality control and so on of some of the items that we would like to see, or Energy Northwest would like to see this panel of experts look at. And it's pretty comprehensive. Then I skipped out, went to Waputo, and I'll save that to later. Then they have at the CNSRB, the Nuclear Safety Review Board, they have a get-together, a meeting at the end to talk about conclusions and identify areas of weakness that they found, plus areas where we are doing very well. The what really came out of that, and I'll be very brief, the biggest problem that the nuclear plant has is equipment reliability. There's a lot of that equipment. For example, there's variable speed drives, which drive the primary pumps for the water to the reactor. And these variable speed drives are very old. They're not supported by any manufacturer. They've been reverse engineering the cards in those for a number of years, and just recently the components to reverse engineer those cards are becoming difficult or impossible to find. So that's going to entail spending some pretty large tens of millions of dollars to replace those in the future, and it's on the long-term plan, but may have to be moved up. So that was the major problem. There was improvements in human performance, a couple of departments, including security, which has been a bit of a problem in the past. We've really improved their performance. And the key to that is each of the Safety Review Board members have to make a statement that they see no nuclear safety concerns. So that's a good thing. So then I skipped over to Waputo, and as Jim said, we had an assistant AG in there to talk about the Open Public Meetings Act and went through all the requirements and also the Public Records Act. Kind of funny, I've attended a number of those. In fact, you have to attend them periodically. You get a little certificate at the end. You don't always hear the same thing, so I don't know what that's a function of, but we'll be compliant with whatever is necessary. Also, this assistant AG made a statement at the end that for the Open Public Meetings Act and the Public Records Act, there is legislation ongoing or coming which is going to tighten up all of those things and change some of the requirements. So we need to really follow that very closely. We went through, and Jim covered some of this, we went through some of the legislation that's pending, and as Jim said, that changes daily. And so I think there's no sense talking about that. Tim Sheldon was in on that call, and he's in the state Senate, and he has concerns about the Climate Commitment Act, some of the requirements of that. What he suggested was that they add discussion on the Texas and California scenarios and what happened there and lessons learned, so that we can avoid those type of incidents in the Northwest. Let's see. Talked about the low carbon fuel legislation, which is going to really drive up the cost of automobile fuel in the short term for sure. Also, there was discussion about there's a moratorium on turnoffs, on being arrears in utility bills and so on, unpaid bills. They gave a number of something like $17 million. Waputo polled all the PUDs, and right now PUDs are $17 million in arrears, and that's increasing. In fact, it has increased since that meeting, I'm sure. Some of the legislation that's being discussed to address this is more or less directed towards renters, not by just every utility customer, but just specifically directed at renters, which is seems a little short-sighted. There's also there was discussion about giving some relief from state taxes that our utilities pay, and to provide some relief, and that actually made it. It's in the legislature now, I believe, and being discussed. Actually, there was a discussion, a presentation given by Nicholas, one of the analysts there at Waputo, on the Texas situation. I had to kind of challenge him because he said up front that he got most of his information from CNN, which made it a little suspect to me. But also he kept describing what happened in Texas as rolling brownouts. And I've been talking to people in Texas. They were not rolling brownouts. They lost power for weeks during an excessively cold, historically cold period. And there were a number of deaths where people were sitting out in the garage running their automobile just to stay warm and died from carbon monoxide poisoning. So I don't think it's in best interest to trivialize what happened there. There's lessons to be learned from that, and I think we need to follow up with that. Anyway, I'll stop there. We also had meetings for our task force for selection of a new CEO. And basically what we recommended to the executive board was that we have three very good internal candidates who could move into that position. there's a preference by the board to use an internal candidate as CEO. But there's a few people who would like to go outside and see what's available. The thinking there is that Energy Northwest has become kind of a banner and carrier for the nuclear industry. With our agreements with X-Energy and TerraPower for new modular reactor designs, and the fact that we can tap into the $4 billion the Department of Energy has allocated for that effort, there probably be a lot of people that would like to get involved in that and would like to be the CEO of that organization doing that. So we're still working that issue. We'll see. Right now it stands that we may have an interim CEO and then look outside or select from an internal candidate. But that's kind of an ongoing thing. So to be continued. You know, I think we've been at this for over 2 hours. Let's take a short break and come back for this last item. How long do you think that'll be, Doug? Do you think that'll be, do we need to have a break?
That'll be at least 30 minutes, Will.
Okay, let's take a 5-minute break.
Okay.
Okay, is everybody back? Okay, let's move on to the next item, which is staff reports. We have a transmission system overview and design of the Airport Road to BPA Port Angeles transmission rebuild and voltage upgrade. Ben, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Happy to be here today. So I prepared a PowerPoint slideshow to just talk to you, kind of give you an overview of the transmission system as we receive power from BPA and how it's delivered throughout our district. So I'm going to share my screen here with you. Hopefully everyone can see the PUD logo there.
Yes, we can see it.
All righty. So why is my slide not advancing? I'm sorry. I apologize. Give me just a second. I thought I had this all figured out, but my slide is not advancing because I need to, apparently.
It's a common problem.
Yeah, this is...
You're not by yourself.
It hijacked my monitor that I had the slideshow presentation up when I went to share. Do you see it now?
Yes, sir.
All right. excuse me. The PUD receives transmission power from BPA originating from Shelton. That line then travels up along the Hood Canal, out the Olympic Peninsula, and finally terminates at the BPA Sappho substation out near the West End. In this slide here, the blue line is the BPA transmission line from the BPA delivery point in Fairmont, which is at Discovery Bay. We'll talk about in a minute. BPA has two 230 kV lines that come up to Port Angeles, and then from there they have a single 115 kV line that terminates in Forks. So we have some measure of redundancy from up to Port Angeles, but just a single BPA transmission line that goes out to Forks. The BPA has five potential, or excuse me, the PUD can receive power from BPA at five potential points of delivery. We have 19 distribution substations, and we have 110 miles of 69 and 115 kV transmission. In this slide here, the five red boxes are the five points of delivery. We'll talk about each one specifically as we move forward here. Our normal transmission system is configured such that the PUD receives power from BPA at four of those locations and one is an alternate. And we divide our district up such that each is independent from sort of an island from the other. The first service area is Squim, where we receive power at Happy Valley, and that serves five substations. And we have two feeders that lead from Port Angeles, Port Angeles Central Feeder and the Eastern Feeder, which together feed six PD substations. And then we have delivery at BPA Silverado, which is out of Joyce, and that currently serves two PD substations for a total of 13 in the Port Angeles Squim area. And finally, we have the West End, which originates at Sappho, a total of six substations serving CQ, Niobe, and Forks. The first point of delivery is, which is our alternate point of delivery, is BPA Discovery Bay, which I've shown over here. And this line here, we do keep energized, so we always know if it can be used. But this line is only used in the event of an emergency or if we need to have an alternate point of delivery that we're not able to take power from one of our other four primary. That line originates at Discovery Bay. This here is the BPA Fairmont substation. We actually receive that power through Jefferson County PUD transmission lines. And here at Discovery Bay, there's a switching station, which is where the PUD lines connect to the Jefferson County lines. And that's how we're able to receive power from Discovery Bay. Down here in the lower portion of the picture, you can see the corridor for the two 230 kV transmission lines that are going into Port Angeles from Discovery Bay. The next point of delivery is DPA Happy Valley, serving five substations, Blinn, Dunce Creek, Sunland Prairie, and Evergreen. The Happy Valley substation is located south of Squim, behind Bell Hill a little bit. And here you can see this is the BPA transmission lines coming through. Our next point of delivery is at Port Angeles. We have 115 kV eastern feeder, which serves five PUD substations. And then we have our only 69, at least in the Port Angeles and Squim area, the only 69 kV transmission line, which currently serves just Airport Substation. BPA Port Angeles is located next to the Peninsula College, from which our two feeders leave, the eastern feeder heading east, of course, and the 69 kV feeder heading west. Our fourth point of delivery is BPA Silverado, which serves two substations. BPA Silverado is located out at Joyce behind Crescent School, a short distance. And here, the red line is the BPA transmission line coming through, and then this is the PUD transmission line coming up to the substation. And finally, we have BPA Sappho, which has two feeders, one going to Forks and the other going out to CQ and Nia Bay. BPA Sappho is located a little bit past Hungry Bear Calf there, just before the 113 turnoff to Clallam Bay and CQ. And again, there's two feeders that leave there, 169 kV feeder to CQ and Nia Bay and 169 kV feeder to Forks. We have future plans for our transmission system, which will create a completely looped 115 kV feeder in the Port Angeles and Squim area, and also provide full BPA source redundancy for us. To accomplish this, the PUD started originally the central feeder from Port Angeles heading west out to Joyce, which is this yellow line here. It consisted of 21 miles, 69 kV radial transmission line, and it served four PUD substations. Starting back in 2006 to 2009, PUD established a new point of delivery, which we call Silverado, and that's where our Silverado substation is. We accept power there at 115 kV, and that retired two older PUD substations. And then the PUD from 2010 to 2018 began a process of rebuilding that feeder from 69 kV to 115 kV, starting at the western end and working back towards Port Angeles. In 2013 and 2014, our Laird Corner substation was modernized and upgraded to be a 115 kV substation. Excuse me. This year, we are planning to rebuild our Airport substation from 69 kV to 115 kV. That'll happen this summer. And that leaves 3.3 miles of transmission from Airport to BPA in Port Angeles, and also planned switching yard, which we'll touch on here in a minute, PUD switching yard. So the upgrade of Airport substation will move once it's converted to 115 kV, Airport substation will then be fed from BPA Silverado. This will just be a temporary configuration until we're able to complete the complete 115 rebuild all the way to BPA Port Angeles. When that's finished, BPA Silverado will only serve one PUD substation. Laird Corner and Airport will both then be fed from a Port Angeles feeder. Again, the plan is to rebuild that what remains of the 69 kV feeder to a full 115 so that this is all 115 between Port Angeles and Silverado. We have two projects left to complete that, which is starting at Airport Substation to BPA Port Angeles to rebuild that line to 115 kV. Phase one will take us to Cherry Street, and that's scheduled for construction this summer. That's the project that was approved at the last board meeting. And then in 2022, we'll do phase two, which will rebuild it all the way to Port Angeles. Additionally, we'll be building a switching station. The switching station will, a normal configuration will be still, as we have it now, an eastern feeder and a central feeder, but we'll also have a switch here where we're able to tie both lines together if we need to. The switching station will be located right here on PUD property, which is located right across from the BPA substation. And then again, the two feeders, the eastern feeder will leave and the central feeder will leave to the west. And once that's complete, then we will have we'll be able to supply the entire SQUIM and Port Angeles system from any one of the four BPA substations. Any one of those will be able to carry the entire system. We'll still maintain our normal configuration where we have three distinct areas just for reliability, but it gives us a lot more flexibility to be able to deliver transmission power. So that's the end of that presentation. Any questions on any of that?
Sounds like that will improve reliability in a number of areas. What about the far west end?
The west end, as mentioned, we've only got the single BPA feeder that goes out there. There is no redundancy there. And then we have single feeders at 69 kV heading off in two different directions. So they're both all radial feeders. There's no real possibility of redundancy there, nor any plans that I'm aware of to add such.
Okay. Thank you.
So the next thing I've got here is a video that I made earlier this year, which talks about transmission line design and then also talks about a new software program that the PUD purchased for designing transmission lines. So I'll go ahead and start that if I can. The engineering department has been hard at work designing the next phases of transmission pole replacement projects. I'm going to pause that just for a second. Is that video coming through?
Yes, but the volume's a little low.
I will turn up the volume here. The engineering department has been hard at work designing the next phases of transmission pole replacement projects. This project involves the replacement of transmission poles beginning at Airport Substation along Highway 101 through the Tumwater Valley, up along Lawrenson Boulevard, past Ray Street, Franklin Elementary, and Crestwood, going all the way to the BPA substation in Port Angeles near the college. Traditionally, a program called AutoCAD has been used to design these projects. In the fall of 2019, the district purchased a program called PLSCAD, a program made specifically for the design of transmission lines. PLSCAD is a superior product in this case because it is a three-dimensional model of the conductors, poles, insulators, and other equipment used. It is a three-dimensional model of the ground terrain underneath of our conductors. It is a smart design. Changes propagate across the entire model. It is an accurate description of the components used in the model, including material properties of poles, conductors, and other elements. The program is then able to do what is called a finite element analysis, whereby loads are placed upon the equipment, and by checking against the material properties, it can determine whether or not that equipment will fail or not. And changes to the design are very easy. This project has some unique challenges in terms of the loadings that our structures will see. There are 4 H structures for long crossings through the Tumwater Valley. There are 5 poles with City of Port Angeles utilities on them, including distribution and transmission. And there are 8 poles which share transmission lines with McKinley Paper. At 1,264 feet and 772 feet, the Long Valley crossings through the Tumwater Valley are particularly challenging because we want our conductors to always stay up under all weather conditions that might be seen. In designing these projects, the goal is to ensure that the conductor clearance to ground and other structures always meets the minimum distances as specified by the National Electric Safety Code. Conductor sag can change quite a bit as the temperature changes. For example, if we were to look at a 1,260-foot span of 556 ACSR conductor between 0 and 120 degrees Fahrenheit, the sag will change over 12 feet. Conductor sag will also change depending upon the type of conductor used. Here, looking at a 556 ACSR conductor, which is an aluminum conductor with a steel core, as compared to a 556 AAC, which is an all-aluminum conductor, on a 300-foot span, the difference in sag between 0 degrees and 120 degrees Fahrenheit is 1.6 feet difference between the two of them. The tension of the conductor will also change as the temperature changes. For example, on a 300-foot span of 556 ACSR conductor at 0 degrees Fahrenheit, the conductor is pulling on the pole with a force of 6,426 pounds. At 120 degrees Fahrenheit, it's pulling with a force of 2,182 pounds. With 7 conductors per pole, 3 transmission and 4 distribution,
That equates to a force at 0 degrees Fahrenheit of almost 45,000 pounds, or 22.5 tons, going on our pole. At 120 degrees, that force reduces to 15,000 pounds, or 7.6 tons. Wind and ice loadings can significantly increase the total forces that the conductors and poles gain. As you can see, conductor sag, which affects ground clearance, and conductor tension, which affects pole strength, varies quite a bit and depends upon the type of conductor used, the temperature, and additional loads and wires. All will behave differently. The PUD has construction specifications, which dictate the minimum distances between all pieces of equipment placed upon the poles. Our construction standards specify from the top down the minimum distances that each piece of equipment must be placed. From the bottom up, we then also have design clearances that we're looking to maintain: 32 feet for transmission, 27 for distribution, and 20 for communications. In order to properly evaluate clearances, we need to have an accurate profile of the ground line underneath our line. With the ground profile established, I can offset that ground profile by the minimum distances we're looking to maintain based on type of conductor. We never want to see the conductor sag interfering with the ground profile. That would be a violation. Conductor sag must always stay above the ground profile at all times. Traditionally, this information was collected by a manual survey. Manual survey is very labor-intensive due to the large amount of data that must be collected, and it's also potentially dangerous to the surveyor having to work on busy streets. In 2019, the district began employing the use of LIDAR to collect this information. LIDAR stands for Light Detection and Ranging. An airplane flies over the corridor we are looking to map, shooting a laser at the ground. That light is reflected back to the airplane, and by measuring the time it takes to reflect back, they are able to determine a distance and thus accurately model the ground surface underneath. This information is accurate to within 6 inches. What this LIDAR data gives us is millions and millions of points in 3D space. Taken all by themselves, these points don't look like much. But as we begin to zoom out, you can see they begin to take on a form. Rotating the model around in 3D space, you can begin to make out the contours of the ground underneath. Here we're looking at the Tumwater Valley and the flat road surface of Highway 101 running alongside it. From all of the LIDAR ground data, we can infer what happens to the ground contour in between each of those points. From that, we can create a very accurate 3D representation of the entire ground surface. Once again, here looking at the Tumwater Valley with Pine Street entrance coming into Highway 101. As you can see, taken all together, these points begin to create a very accurate description of the ground profile underneath. The LIDAR data is also able to give us above ground information. Because there is so much more stuff there, there is about 10 times the amount of data. Once again, looking down at it from the top, it doesn't look like much. But as you begin to rotate it in 3D space, you can see trees take form, our conductors and poles take shape, even down to the bus work inside of airport substation seen here. From the LIDAR data, we're also able to see existing structures and conductors. From this, we can calculate what the existing attachment heights are or what the existing sag of the line is, should we need to know that. All of this from millions of points in space. Once the ground surface has been created, it is time to start modeling, first by building the poles. All of the different types of poles and structures that will be used in the design must be modeled. Here, we're looking at a simple tangent transmission and distribution pole. Here we have a double dead-end transmission and distribution pole attached with a span guide to a secondary span guide pole. Here we are looking at one of the eight structures that will be used in the long valley crossing through the Tumwater Valley. This structure requires many guys to make it strong enough to properly sustain the conductors under all weather conditions that we will present to it. We are also able to model equipment attached to the pole. In this case, the square boxes represent a transmission switch. This is important information to have because the switch can add additional load under wind and ice conditions besides the weight of the switch itself. Once all the various types of poles and structures have been created, I can begin adding them to the model. Survey points indicate where each pole will be placed. adding the type of structure at that location to the survey point, and changing it for the various different types of structures that will be used as we go down the line. Next, it is time to add conductors to the model, selecting from wire files that have the material properties for each different type of conductor used in the model. Now it is time to begin stringing lines. Lines are strung between dead ends, here attaching a transmission line section between four structures. After stringing the wire, we select the type of wire that will be used, 556, select the voltage level, 115 kV, set initial conditions for the wire, and we now have our transmission line. Going on to add the distribution lines, again, between dead ends. Once again, selecting the type of wire that will be used, selecting the voltage level, setting the weather conditions, and in this case, changing it to a blue color to differentiate it. And you can see that now we have the distribution conductors strung. Once all of the different types of pole structures have been placed into the model and conductors strung, you can see that we now have a 3D representation of the entire transmission line and all of the various structures used within it. We're also modeling any other lines attached to the poles, as they will have an effect on the forces that each structure must withstand. Now, when we combine everything that has been modeled so far together, we finally have a full 3D model of our conductors, poles, and ground underneath of it. Here again, looking at the Tumwater Valley and all the various structures that go through there up to the top of the hill by Oak Street and Sars Grocery. Here we are looking at the portion of the line on the eastern end of the project, starting at Ray Street on the left, going along Lordson Boulevard in front of Franklin Elementary in Crestwood, where we have McKinley Power Lines, shown in purple, attached to our structures as well. Moving on up to the end of the line, where we turn 90 degrees and go into the BPA substation. Here you can see the Port Angeles eastern feeder coming in on the right, the western feeder, of which we're rebuilding, coming in on the left, as well as the McKinley line also coming in. Now it is time to evaluate the design. We do this by establishing our design criteria, evaluating conductor clearance to ground, and finally evaluating the strength of the poles. First, we define the weather conditions that we want the model analyzed under, defining the various weather conditions, which are unique to our particular part of the world, and defining extreme conditions, such as 90-mile-per-hour winds, or in the case of the Tumwater Valley crossing, we don't ever want those conductors to come down, so we're designing such that if all conductors ahead of that valley crossing were to come down, the poles would still stay standing. Now it is time to evaluate conductor clearances using worst-case sag for our clearance check. Now that we have everything modeled, we can begin analyzing. Here, looking at the profile view, the dashed lines represent the ground clearances we're trying to maintain. I can now evaluate conductor sag under various temperature conditions. Here, we're looking at 0 degrees Fahrenheit. I can change that to 120 degrees Fahrenheit, and you can see the conductor sag change. Or take it all the way up to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, and the sag changes again. Next, we must correct any sag violations, where the conductor has sagged below the ground profile, thus indicating an interference. Where there is an interference with our sag, such as here, where the distribution conductor has sagged below our minimum design clearance, I can then go in and change the pole in the model. Here, changing it from a 70-foot tall pole to a 75-foot tall pole. By changing it, the conductors raise up and we now clear. Finally, it is time to evaluate pole strength. Is the pole going to be strong enough to do what we are asking it to do? The color gradient shows whether or not the pole will fail, with anything red indicating that it exceeded the material properties and thus the pole will fail. Now it is time to begin checking structure strength. The program goes through and evaluates each pole, and the color gradient shows us whether or not it passes or fails. Here, the base of this pole is turned red, which means that it's failed. It's not strong enough. I can correct this by going in and changing that pole out to a stronger pole. In this case, changing it from a class H1 to a stronger class H2 pole. Having replaced the pole, I now do a structure check, and I can see that that pole now passes. This structure, with the two City of Port Angeles transmission spans attached to the top of it, will need to be particularly strong to support all of the conductors that are attached to it. When I analyze the structure doing a structure check, program will tell me here that it has failed. By analyzing the deflection of the pole, this PLS cat shows me how it deflects under the forces placed upon it, and can begin to figure out how to correct the problem, either a stronger pole or adding more guides. PLS CAD also allows us to evaluate unusual conditions, such as galloping. Galloping is a phenomenon where the wind blowing across the conductors causes them to begin swinging around in large circles, potentially causing the conductors to hit, a condition we would never have happen. When analyzing for galloping in the PLS model, the program draws circles to describe the path the conductor will take as it swings. In this case, you can see that they're all red, which means that the lines are interfering. We will have to install space. We can also evaluate the design using Google Earth imagery. This allows us to get an idea of how the line interacts with the environment around it. Google Earth imagery is imported into the model and shown underneath of the transmission lines. This imagery allows us to get a good visual of the entire corridor and what lies underneath and around it. We are also able to show easement and right-of-way boundaries to ensure we stay within the area we are allowed to occupy. Next, it is time to create construction drawings, giving plan and profile views needed for construction. Traditionally, this was AutoCAD and all manually drawn. PLS CAD makes the creation of construction drawings very simple. From the 3D model, plan and profile views are automatically generated and sheets are created for the entire project line. PLS CAD also allows the 3D model to be exported to a Google Earth file. With the model exported to Google Earth, this file can now be given to vendors bidding on the project to give them a very clear idea of what it is they're building and also enable them to get some idea of the challenges they may face in terms of terrain and structure along the way. This file can also be useful for construction crews on site to be able to use as a reference at each location to see what it is that they will be building. As you can see, PLS CAD is a very powerful design tool that is very accurate and greatly simplifies the design process. Thank you very much for your time. If you have any questions or would like to know more, please feel free to contact Ben Phillips in engineering.
And that's my presentation. Any questions I can answer?
Ben, that was very impressive. As an old slide rule engineer, I am impressed.
Thank you, sir.
All that design work internally, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good.
Hey, Ben, this is Jim. I assume the structural analysis on the poles and so forth and everything attached to it is has earthquake stress criteria included in that?
Yes, we can add that if we want to. We establish in one of the slides there is a lot of information, but there's a whole list of different weather conditions. And so by adding varying weather conditions, we can simulate things such as an earthquake, yes.
Okay, the earthquake is considered a weather condition in the analysis there.
I actually haven't done this on this model. I would have to actually talk with PLS on how to do that, but I'm certain that it can be done.
Yeah, well, I assume that given where we are, we'd want to do that at some point.
To be honest, I guess I hadn't considered that one, so you're correct. That might be something we should be looking at.
Hey, Jim, this is John. In our area, in Formosa Utilities, no one is taking earthquake design beyond substations in our region. The cost of implementing a substation design increases cost by an order of magnitude, at least double the cost. That's for substations as well as pole line designs, as well as underground. And due to the difference in mean time between events, it becomes not cost feasible to attempt to do an earthquake design for all pole line designs. The history of earthquakes demonstrates that pole lines are least susceptible to damages due to earthquakes due to the flexibility of the pole itself. Now, that doesn't apply to substations and underground facilities, but for pole lines, very few, if any, utilities in the United States are doing earthquake designs on poles.
So, as I recall, there are different seismic zones. I assume that you're looking at a seismic zone that we're involved in here. And
yeah, so basically, if you're looking at, let's say, a bulk electric system transmission tower, there's earthquake considerations. But when you get down to wood and fiberglass poles and the flexibility, we simply do not do that level of design for pole lines. And I do not even believe California is doing that for actual distribution and single pole transmission. I may be wrong. But if anyone's doing it, would be California. Until the last, most recent my knowledge, they're focused on survivability of substations.
So what kind of safety factors built into this software?
Okay, so basically we, Ben, you want to handle that? Safety factors?
So we have materials. Everything is based upon real material properties. We use Shakespeare poles or our fiberglass poles, or actually in this case we use a manufacturer called RS poles, and they've got modulus of elasticity properties, thermal expansion coefficient properties, the actual real properties of the of what's being used. Same thing with the conductors. So by modeling it and then placing these weather loads on it, we basically so the factor of safety we basically build into our weather conditions. We've designed to an extreme wind case of 90 miles an hour. We got that number by getting NOAA wind data going back as far as they could give us, which was about 30 years, to establish what our maximum wind should be. And then we've also got an extreme case of quarter-inch ice, based in which is a very good historical average for this area as well. So once I've designed it to be able to withstand all of those weather conditions, we consider that it's built strong enough to withstand what we're asking it to do without necessarily applying a factor of safety per se.
Okay. Thank you.
Ben, is this you gave a good illustration of a primary transmission line with a distribution line underneath it. Do you are you using this for the distribution lines that go off into the neighborhoods and stuff like that, or is this really for our bigger infrastructure?
It could be used for that, but it's really for our bigger infrastructure. The transmission poles, of course, being taller, they're seeing considerably much, a whole lot more force than a distribution pole is going to see. So it's primarily for the design of our transmission lines, but if we have a distribution line that we think might see some unusual conditions, it could certainly be modeled in this program as well.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Ben, very good presentation. Other questions, comments?
Thank you, Will.
Ben, I think you did a good job.
Thank you, Rick. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Good job, Ben.
Yeah, good job. All right. Next item is action items. T, did you get some action items?
I did, Will. We have the one action item for staff. They were directed to come up with either a letter and or a resolution in support of the Snake River Dams.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's going to be a resolution. So, okay, we're back to comments from the public. Sean?
Looks like we've lost the majority of the public that was on here, but if anybody wants to make a comment, go ahead and let me know now, please. Hearing none, Will.
Okay, well, good. Well, all right, then. I guess there's no executive session, so if there's no other business to come before the board, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thanks.